Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. Our next guest, 10-time PGA Tour winner. He won a PGA Championship. He won two Players' Championships. It's the Players' Championship week this week. So perfect guest to have on, Mr. Steve Elkington. Elk, what is happening?
Good morning, fellas. I'm only a fat wedge shot from your studio. So I thought about coming over to hit a few balls before and after this deal, but the weather's so cold here, can't even get outside.
It's warm inside here, though, Elk.
Yeah, I know. I've been there. It's good. Yeah. Your place is the best.
Well, we're happy to have you on. So what do you think? Do you get fired up for TPC week like I do?
You know what I'm really fired up this week about is I'm fired about the potential weather on Sunday. That they're saying it might be a high of 50 degrees with a north wind blowing 25. So I'm fired up for those guys to stand on 17 and 18. You know, you see this course, it's not a long course, as you know, and it doesn't really suit, you know, long hitters. I mean, long hitters you would think could play well there because they can lay up every hole, but it sort of seems to, I don't know, I'll be interested to hear what you think, but it seems to suit a medium range hitter, you know, someone that can be aggressive off the tee, keep the ball in play. But, you know, the years that I won this tournament, I hit a driver and a 3-iron on 18 and a driver and a 4-iron the 2 years that I won. So I want to see somebody hit other than a wedge in there on Sunday.
Well, I think you're right. I think it does favor the medium hitter. You know, holes like number 14, you know, the really big hitters, that's a tough driving hole. And, you know, they can't really use their distance on that hole. So I agree with you on that. And weather is always a factor. If there is wind at TPC, it just makes it that much tougher to play.
Yeah, I was looking at go ahead, Chase.
I was going to say, Elk, if there's a north wind, how's 17 going to play? Which direction does the wind blow there?
I would say it's in off the left, Hal, which would be vicious. You know, in 91, when I was lucky enough to win this tournament, I was pretty young. I'd only been on tour a few years, and I got paired with Curtis Strange on Sunday, and I was looking at this picture up there of me on 18, but Curtis wasn't having a great day. He was wearing a red shirt back then, Hal. He was kind of the red shirt guy before Tiger wore the red shirt. He wore it on both U.S. Open victories, but he had the red shirt on that day, and I thought, oh, God, I'm going to play with a two-time U.S. Open champion on Sunday. This is going to be a little bit nerve-wracking, but at any rate, I got to 17, and Curtis wasn't having a great day. I was near the lead of the tournament in 91. And it was into the wind. It was kind of one of those blustery deals where the wind, the pins flicking back and forth. And Curtis, I think, he liked to chip the ball a little bit like Hal did. He would, when I say chip it, he would hit an arm swing and keep it down. And I think he took a 6-iron, I think, and chipped it onto the green into that wind. And I told Bullitt, my caddy, when he came over, I said, what did he hit? And don't tell me anything other than an 8. This is what I said to him. And he looked at me and he said, he smoked an 8. Yeah. So I grabbed my 8 and I found the land. I don't know what it was like for you, Hal, in the wind over there, but you know, I saw a YouTube video of you when you hit it stiff there one of the times, but there's, I have a video and I'm going to send it to you, Chase, after this. I pulled up Calvin Pete, TPC, and they've got him over an 8-iron there, 149 yards. Is it me, Hal? Did we walk uphill to school in the snow every day, or did we play the 17th hole longer than they do now?
Yeah, well, I think we did play it a little bit longer than they do, but I don't know. You know, I remember in 83, the first time I won, I hit 8-iron there. The wind was blowing off the left side and into us out of the north. I shot 69 the last day. I hit it, you know, like you saw, about 6 inches on 18 with an 8-iron. And you don't ever see anybody hit anything like that anymore.
I looked close. I'll send both you guys a video of Cal Pete. It might be interesting to tack it onto this video, but looked like the tee was further to the right. It looked like it was closer to the 16th green than it was, than it is today. Because as I was looking from behind, Cal, on that shot on YouTube, it looked like the little small bunker on the green was very much right in his view. It wasn't to the right. But I don't know what your recollection is. I played there first time probably in 87.
Well, my recollection is it was really hard.
How did you guys with the back right pin? So we've talked on this podcast a lot about last year when we had Westwood and Bryson, and who ended up winning last year? Was it JT, right?
Yeah, JT won.
Yeah, we had Westwood and Bryson coming down the stretch, and that pin's back right, or you know, on the right half of that green, right side of that green, and you know, they both hit it a little bit left, almost like they were kind of, you know, protecting a little bit. And Hal was, you know, kind of adamant, like if he was their caddy at that time, he would have said, hey, it's time to go for your moment, Lee. It's time to, you know, win over here. Let's take on that pin. How did you always handle that back right pin when you were chasing versus if you're, you know, in the lead and protecting a little bit more?
Well, in 91, I was thankful to hit the island at all. You know, that was a nerve-wracking shot. But, you know, I was talking yesterday a little bit about TPC, and I always played safety first a little bit. I mean, you know, everyone knows on 17, I think, that if you do hit the ball a little left of the flag there, it works its way down to the flag anyway. I was – there's probably a handful of shots at this course that I never really liked to shoot at, like how down – you know, I didn't like to shoot down to the pin on number 4. I didn't like to shoot down to the pin on 13. I would play the slope on a lot of those. It just gave me more room. And, you know, invariably, the guy that wins at this tournament is hitting the ball almost exactly where he's looking every time. I mean, you just can't play this course unless you're on. I mean, if you're off, you're out of there on Friday anyway. So it seems like at the, you know, end of the week, you know, you're hitting the irons pretty much where you're looking.
Well, I was on this morning on another podcast, and one of the things that I said is everybody has a volatile record at TPC because of the statement you just made. If you're on, you're effective there. And if you're not on, you're out of there on Friday night. And
you're out, yeah.
I mean, it's that on the edge. It's a typical Pete Dye. If you're hitting it where you're looking, you're going to play pretty good. And if you're not hitting it where you're looking, then you're not going to have a good week.
Yeah. And Pete Dye, you know, I spent a fair bit of time with Pete Dye. When I helped design him a course down in Louisiana, I learned a lot from him, but he's really the only designer. There may be a few others, but he's one designer for sure that changes your mood when you get on the tee. I mean, you walk on the tee on 14, you talked about it earlier, and he puts all these things in front of your face where down the left, you've got water, you've got bunker, and automatically you tend to look to the right, and up there's no good either. And he's got you off kilter right out of the gate. And on 18, everyone that listens to this show knows 18. He told me he put that tee so that he almost could hear the water slapping on the player's ankles. And he angled that, you know, that bulkhead so that it looked even more intimidating. And of course, what do you want to do at 18? You want to stay away from that on that bulkhead. But really the place to go on these Pete Dye courses is if you can hit the ball down the line that he doesn't want you to go, that's what opens it up. I mean, you can just walk through the course and every hole, if you can get it down that trouble line where he's putting a lot of visual, it opens it up.
Elk, how did you attack 18?
You know, there's a fork tree up there, Hal, you might remember it. It's like up in it's an open fork up there where those ospreys sit. It's about 295 yards run out up there. I would pretty much try to smoke a 3-wood up that right side. I mean, unless it was into the wind playing a driver. But I'll tell you a funny story. I got paired with Nicholas there in like 19, I don't know, it was like 88 or 9. I was wondering why the heck I was in this group with Jack Nicklaus. I don't even know how I got paired with him, but we teed off the back nine first on a Thursday. Come around to 18. I'm only a kid, and he had just won the Masters at, you know, age 46. and it's just millions of people out there. And he got an 18 and he smoked this one iron out there, right? You know, just the most gorgeous shot you've ever seen. And I was thinking to myself, well, I'm not going to hit a one iron. I'm not going to hit a one iron like that. I can't do that. So I'm just going to hit driver. You know, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to hit a driver. And I kind of pulled it and it looked like it was going to go in the water, but it carried the water and ran out there perfect. Well, he didn't say anything. The next day we come all the way around again and we get on 18 again. And he hits another beautiful long iron, one iron up to the right. And I'm in the same boat. I'm going to hit driver again. Cause I'm not going to hit one iron after Jack hit one iron. Just, I'm not going to hit it like that. And I pulled it again, except this time I pulled it a little bit more. Now it's really going to go in the water, but somehow it carried again and ran out there even more perfect. And we're walking up the fairway and we had spoke during the day, but he looked at me and he goes, well, I guess you pushed it yesterday, is what he said to me. I said, Jack, yeah, I just left it at that.
That's awesome. Did, you know, Elk, you've obviously, we've spent some time in here and we've talked about how you played and different stuff. Did you tended to like to cut it maybe later on in your career. Would you take on the water and ever work it away from the water there?
On 18?
Yeah.
I usually twist myself around and get my back a little bit more towards the water, make sure I was, because I like to play open. You know that. I come up there and you know, we get on the video and look at my swing. I had a particular shot, and you talked about it at the top, where I had two ways that I like to fade it, and I had two ways that I like to draw it. And I was only really good at one way to draw it with my longer club, and that was a bit of a shift out to the right with the face closing a little bit. So I could play that draw 3-wood pretty nice. Couldn't do it as good with my driver, but I could hit the 3-wood real nice right to left. So that hole really wasn't a big factor for me. 18. I don't think I've ever gone in the water there. Have you ever hooked it in the water on 18, Hal?
Not that I can
remember. I mean, I'm not saying you did, but I'm saying you probably would remember it. I just haven't ever done it. I put it in the right rough a ton, but not in the water.
Yeah. I hooked it in the water on my second shot one time at the middle left pin.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did. I hooked it in there and I dropped it right there and hit it again and hit it about 6 feet and made the putt. So I remember that distinctly because I was so angry with myself having done that. But, you know, I was like you. I played a 3-wood off the tee most of the time, got my back a little bit more to the water and hit that draw 3-wood, occasionally left it out there and it was in the right rough. But I avoided the big hole there usually because I didn't hit the ball in the water. That's the way you make a big score there.
Yeah. And there's some other holes on this course that you don't hear much about, but I did some flyovers yesterday, some drawings, and number 2 is an easy par 5, but it messes up a lot of people because it's the second hole of the day, and you've got to hook it pretty much right out of the gate. And, you know, guys have just come off the range. I don't know if they're working on their swing or whatever, but I found that a lot of guys had a lot of trouble at 2, and I would do the same shot there. I didn't try to go for too much distance at 2. I just wanted to curve it. I would get it out way out right and bring it back and just get it in play. Also 4 was a hard shot off the tee because you want to keep that up the right. 5 was probably one of the hardest driving shots, I think, you know, on that course. And 7, those two there, 5 and 7. I mean, you basically got to hit your best shot on both those holes, probably with a little power fade to keep it up there on the right side to get a look-see at the green, don't you think?
Love 5 and 7 tee shots. Because the guy that had a lot of confidence felt like he could hit the shot. And the guy that was weak in confidence, those were tough.
Yeah.
Do you guys think it's more important to drive it well out there or iron it better?
Well, I was just going to ask Hal, what would be the club that you can't, you know, what you have to have this week? You know, I did our podcast yesterday and I have Morikawa. I think the driver is the most important club. We saw Morikawa win at the Open Championship with a 3-wood. It was nice to see that. And what I like about the Players' Championship this week is it's got a lot of rough. So the tour has made a decision that for $20 million, they're not going to let anyone win from the rough. And there's a ton of big hitters on our tour. There's a ton of, you know, Colin Morikawa, I think he's number two ranked player in the world. He only has 160 mile an hour ball speed. I mean, he's got ball speed about like us, Al, maybe a bit more, maybe 165. But he's not chasing speed. He's chasing accuracy. And he's, I don't know if anyone's ever said he's a throwback player, but he's definitely has plays a slight power fade and he has his ball under control. And I'm not saying he's going to win this week, but I just don't know how you, I look at my list here. I got Sutton, I got Cal Pete, I got Nick Price, I got all these guys that hit the ball a lot like that. I suppose me in there, medium range. I had all these guys' names here. Yep. You know them all, Hal. They medium range, super straight hitters, right?
Well, you know, Greg Norman was longer than us, but he still hit it straight.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what you got to do to play well there. You know, Mark McCumber, well, he wasn't the longest player on the tour either, and he won there. So,
Freddie Funk did the same thing.
Exactly.
Freddie Couples and Davis Love were two guys in our era that were really long players, but, you know, they were accurate that week. I remember seeing, you remember that shot that Davis Love hit the second time he won? He was in the trees left on 16, and he got in there with a long iron and hit it out over the lake and hooked it back on the green. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I've never seen a shot that good, you know, coming out of the trees on 16 out over the water and coming back. So, you know, do you, when you prepare for that tournament, do you prepare like, I'm just going to hit the ball as good as I can, get my swing as good as I can, or do you have to have some strategy? I was telling someone yesterday, I reckon it's a strategy course. And like we talked about a minute ago, is you know where you got to hit it. It's just whether you can or not. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, well, I think strategy is always important in the game of golf. I don't think I ever played a tournament that I didn't have some sort of strategy in my head. Didn't always pan out, obviously, but Pete Dye golf courses demand a strategy, I think. And, you know, I didn't vary a lot from what I was trying to do. I kind of stuck to the game plan, and that's the way I played his courses.
Yeah, and then I said I think the driver is probably the most important club this week. But, you know, you think, was the driver the most important club last week at Bay Hill? Maybe. Wasn't the most important at San Diego. Wasn't the most important at Phoenix. There's a lot of courses that driver's not the most important club. But if you're not in the fairway this week, you're toast. I mean, you can't win this tournament from out of the rough. There's no way.
No, you can't. But there's enough, you know, you hit a lot of three woods on that golf course too.
Yeah.
You hit a three wood on number one. You hit a three wood on number four. You hit a long iron or a three wood on number six. Yeah. You hit a three wood on number 10. You hit a, you know, I hit three wood on 18. The only time I ever hit driver off of 18 was that I can recall was both times that I won. And, I did it in 2000 because I couldn't hit – I hit three wood on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, but I couldn't hit my three wood past Tiger. So I needed – I mean, you know, he hit that stinger two iron down there, and he hit it 270 doing that. I couldn't hit a three wood that far. So in order for me to have the last shot in and know that I had to, you know, make the decision on what I needed to do, how aggressive I needed to be, I hit driver off that hole. And so that I could have the last shot, but I was forced into hit the driver there.
Yeah. And by the time it was in that tournament, that little duel was getting pretty hot and heavy at the end. And you guys were both playing great. And, you know, you're not thinking about your swing that much at that point in the tournament. And you're thinking it more about, you know, Thursday, Friday, getting yourself in position, but it's real. This golf course, I don't know, you know, you play back nine, front nine. What did you like to start on? I always thought the back nine was pretty hard to start on for me. Even though the year that I won, I birdied the first four holes and I won the tournament 97. I never lost the lead the whole week, but the front nine to me seems an easier nine to start on the first 2 days. Or if you haven't even thought about that question.
I hadn't even thought about that question, but that's a pretty – you know, the tee shot at number 10 is a pretty intense tee shot. I saw a lot of guys when they started there, they left it out to the right or they turned it over too much and hit it in that waste bunker to the left. And that's no easy play out of that waste bunker. So I thought the tee shot at number 1 was quite a bit easier than the tee shot at number 10. So maybe number 1, you know, felt like I birdied number 2 a lot more than I birdied number 11. So,
yeah, 11, the par 5 that this course, you know, of course, number 9 was never reachable in our day. I don't think I ever saw anyone get on, but
no.
You have a shot at all the par 5s at this course. And I always felt like if you just get to the front edge on all of them, that's the spot. I don't like flying balls on these greens. 2, if you go over, is bad. 11, you fly on, you bad. And 16, if you fly on, is bad. But I've seen guys do it, but I never did. I never tried to do it. I tried to get my ball to the front edge.
Yeah, well, 11, my favorite place to be was up as far into the bunker as I could be and have a bunker shot into the green. So
that's right.
You know, number 2, I hit it on that green quite a few times. 16, I hit it on the green several times, but 11, you know, I don't think I ever landed it on the green and held it on the green. And I couldn't get to number 9. So,
yeah.
It seems like for a Pete Dye course, there's a lot of forced curves. Like you've got to work it hard on 2, you've got to work it hard on 10. More so than, I mean, I played quite a few Pete Dye courses. I played a lot out at Oak Tree National up in Edmond. Didn't seem, would you guys agree for Pete Dye course, like there's 4 or 5 holes where you have to work it hard off the tee or you're not hitting the fairway?
Well, there's 2 definite draw shots for sure. That would be 2 and 16, right? How? Those 2, 100%. I played fade pretty much all the way, but I'd like to play a power fade.
You have to draw it off 10?
Not really. I mean, how? You don't have to draw it off 10, really?
No, you don't have to draw it off 10. You don't. You know, there's 35, 40 yards of fairway out there, but somehow guys tended to miss number 10 fairway quite a bit.
It just, he does stuff to you on the tee where he's very, very claustrophobic. 10, Hal's talking about. It's claustrophobic back there on 2. It's a little that feel on 5, even though there's no trees back there. It's just that you've got one slither of green up there to hit, a green area to hit to, and it just seems like you're carrying over a lot of trouble to get there. But the power fade, for me, you know, I don't curve the ball that much, but a fade shot really works good around that course, I thought.
So, Al, any other thoughts on players?
I always get excited watching the Players' Championship. I think there's some tense moments out there on the golf course, no matter what kind of player you are. You know, if you're those last 5 or 6 groups, everybody's fairly tense in them. Don't you think, El?
Absolutely. I mean, they can look calm as they want, but that walk from 16 to 17, you'll never forget it in your life if you're near the lead, because the 17th hole is you know, it's a perfect fit for this tournament because it's the last gauntlet you got. Well, it's not quite the last gauntlet, but it's the most important one because you can ruin your week on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday right out of the gate. And you can get unlucky at 17. You can get blustery. And, you know, Hal could hit his ball and have no drama at all, knock it on the green with a 9-iron, and then all of a sudden, you know, a little 20-mile-an-hour, that wind twitches a little bit, and you could get one blow up, and you're double, and you're fighting to make the cut. So you feel like, or at least I did, that 17 is almost an unfair hole, but everyone has to play it all the time. And you know, I've gone through there without too much drama. I've been in the water a couple of times, but it never really cost me the cut. It never really cost me a big thing, you know, at the end. But it's got your attention big time.
Well, I was in 2000, I was cruising there on Saturday. I was in the last group, hitting it great, 4-shot lead, pins in the very back of the green. I carried about a yard too far on 17, and we know the outcome of that. Just couldn't put the brakes on. I made triple on that hole. And all of a sudden, I went from a 4-shot lead to a 1-shot lead. And I can tell you, I went to the 18th tee with a whole lot different attitude than I would have gone had I made par on 17. And then, you know, and contrary, in 83, I birdied that hole every day and when I won there. And, you know, so it's the kind of hole that if there's not much going on, it's not really that hard a shot.
Yeah. How did you approach it? Because I had one approach that worked for me really well. I had my caddy give me the back edge. And he would give me the back edge at like 148, 49, somewhere in there. And I would just think of that number and just hit something real firm to keep it under that one, that back number. I didn't really think too much about the front number because I was always shooting to that middle of that green. I don't know if you were too. Well, I know you shot at the corner on the Sunday, but how did you approach that?
Well, on that, where I hit it so close that day, the wind was blowing about 20 miles an hour left to right and against us. So I hit it at the middle of the green and the wind drifted the ball over there. And, you know, I wasn't, if you'd aimed it at the flag that day, you'd have hit it in the water to the right. So, you know, most of the time I tried to hit it at the slope, like you talked about earlier. Even when the pin was on the front, I tried to hit it into the slope, never at the front of the green. And you know, if I aired a little bit, got it too far, well, I had a tough two putt, but I was dry all the time. And you know, the strategy was to stay out of the aqua if we could.
You remember that little walkway over the back, way back? It used to be sand. You remember that? And it had like a little walkway through the middle. And I was telling this story. That pin one day it was a Friday, and I was playing with Morris Atowski, and Morris was a great putter, as you know. And he was coming in trying to make the cut, and he hit it on the 17 too far, but it ran down that path like safe, but it was in the sand. There was all this sand next to the little walkway.
Right.
And he's left with a shot that he had to play a bunker shot across the water to that back pin. And he went for it. And he got it. He hit the best bunker shot you've ever seen from that walkway across that little nook up there about 5 feet, made par, made the cut. And I told Morris, I said, mate, let's go in and have a drink after that, because that's the best three to make the cut I've ever seen. And he said, I agree. Yo, that was unreal.
Sometimes we hit our best shots when we have no other alternative. We're forced into having to do it.
That's 100% true right there. You have no choice. Sometimes you got to go in at it.
Yep.
So Elk, let's segue on to our next little topic. I'd like to get your take on, we had Brandel on to talk about, you know, the whole Phil debacle in the Saudi league. What's your, you know, don't have to cover or don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but what's your take on just kind of what's going on? This is kind of an interesting week for Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour. This is kind of their flagship event. Luckily, they've kind of moved on from it a little bit, but you know, I heard him answer some questions about it this morning. But what's your take on all this stuff?
Well, I think the players, you know, with Greg Norman involved, you know, he has a huge reputation with our tour, and he's always one of the guys that's always tried to expand the tour to the world tour. He tried to do it before, and you know, Fincham, and he got tangled up, and they finished up doing kind of a world tour, and this is just another chapter in that. You know, the whole Saudi thing, it just seemed like they were just going to go for all the money, all the cash, and try to get all the big players over there and do it. I mean, I know a bunch of the guys, and there was a bunch of them they were talking to, and they called me and asked me what I thought of it. And my advice was to listen to what they were trying to say, you know, without, you know, because it was all a sort of a non-committal thing, or maybe it was, maybe they weren't telling me, but, you know, the way it ended was bad with Phil. I mean, I'm not avoiding anything here. I don't think those guys, if they want to have any legacy on the tour, you know, all the action is here. You know, I don't think you're going to get much golf history over in Saudi playing in those big events, but all the action's on the tour. The tour perfect? Could they change a bunch of things? I mean, Hal could tell you more about that than anyone. Yeah, they could change a bunch of things. And, you know, the tour has been able to sit still during this and receive no criticism, but there's a lot of unhappy people with the tour, and you never hear what they're unhappy about. You know, sponsors are unhappy, spectators are unhappy, media is unhappy. There's a lot of people unhappy with the tour. So maybe, Hal, I'll be interested to hear what you say. I'm not for the Saudi deal. I'm for the tour, but, and I'm not necessarily meaning that they have to get fill the pockets more with for the players, but a lot of players this week said 20 million for this event was too much. They would have rather seen them play for 12 and taken $1 million and put it into 8 other events, because a lot of the tour players are saying, hey, 65, 70 guys are going home empty handed this week anyway. So I'll be interested to hear what you think, Hal.
Well, let's just talk about Phil here for a second. I read something where he's worth $600 million. If he's worth $600 million, I don't know if you can believe anything you read like that, but if he is, the platform in which he made $600 million is called the PGA Tour. And that's how everybody recognizes who Phil Mickelson is. You know, there's nothing is ever perfect, but how do you tear down something that has been so good to you to, in order to initiate change? I think that was a little bit off. And, you know, you mentioned Norman, he's always had a burr in his saddle for the tour. He's always wanted to force them to change. And, you know, when you look at the tour, I mean, as I said, nothing is ever perfect, but they give more money to charity than all three sports put together, all three major sports put together. And, you know, it's been one of those things that amateur golfers can walk right beside Steve Elkington and talk to Steve Elkington at the tournament site. What other sporting event can you do that at? So there's a lot of positives about the PGA Tour, but, you know, if anything, maybe, you know, maybe they don't always figure out how to get better. You know, as a player, Elk, you and I both each year, we're trying to figure out how we could get better. And the tour should probably be trying to do that too. They got, I don't know how many employees they got at the tour now. They used to have 600. I don't know if they got 1,000 now. They probably do. You know, there's probably 1,000 people trying to figure out how to get better. I don't know. The tour was good to me. I'm pretty sure it was good to you. And
I was just following the lead of the older players like you guys. I was just following, you know, it's different when we were there a little bit because we had some older players that you just follow along, right?
Right.
Now it's a bit of a grab, right? Everyone's going for the grab.
Well, I hate the way this whole thing played out. I wish it could have been a collaborated effort and a behind the scenes thing instead of it played out in the media like it has. But anyway, that's, you asked my thoughts. I shared them with you.
Do you think it's over?
Actually, I'm not sure that it is.
I don't think it's over.
I mean, Norman says it's not.
Do you think Bryson's still sitting in the weeds with Phil now that Phil's lost all of his, you know, Phil's been able to dodge a bunch of you know, controversies in his career. And this is really the only time it's ever stuck to him. And I was kind of surprised, not surprised, but, you know, he said a bunch of things about the sorties. Is that where you think the most impactful thing that he said, what he said bad about the sorties? Or do you think, because we all said the same thing over here, and now he, you know, he's getting canceled for saying, and I'm not in his camp at all. Do you think that the meat of what he said was the error was against the sorties? Or do you said he put together an idea to sort of break down the tour a little bit? Or is it a combination?
Well, I think it's a combination, but the thing that hurt me the most was the fact that he put together what he was doing to try to hurt, to make the tour change. To me, you know, I mean, our good friend Jackie Burke said no one's bigger than the game itself. He talked to me a lot about that. I'm sure he talked to you about that. When we'd walk in the locker room, he said, no matter where you go, no name on the locker is bigger than the game itself, and it never will be. And I kind of believe that, you know, but there are some people that challenge that on occasion. And Phil's one of those guys that challenges. And honestly, Greg Norman is too.
Jack used to say that if you think you were great, he said, when you come up eight, I'm an 18, there's 1,000 people around the green and you hole a putt. And he said, you walk off that green, he said, and they open up that gallery for you to walk through. If you walk through and they, the moment you walk through, they turn their eyes back down the fairway to see who the next guy's coming. That's what he told me. He said, if you're so good, they go with you up the hill to the clubhouse, but they never do. He said, they turn around and look for the next guy.
Yeah. He always had a lot of great comments to make about the game.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of star players that are not there right now, and the tour seems to be doing fine. There always seems to be another guy that's stepping up. Scotty Scheffler is playing nice golf right now. That guy can really putt. He's got his game under control. I mean, there's some stars out there right now. Bryson's not playing. Nobody's missing him. Tiger, of course, was the biggest star. Wouldn't be bad to see him come back, but don't know about that. But Phil, nobody's missing Phil. It's the show goes on.
Always has.
Always has.
Elk, how's your game?
My game's pretty good. Yeah, I'm always working on it. I haven't been up there to see you guys that much, but I'm hitting it pretty good. So that's a good sign if I'm not coming up there getting on film with you.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit about, you play a lot of golf with a lot of amateurs. One of the things that we always like to do when we get guys like you on is to try and help our listeners, little tidbits to improve. What are some of the common errors that you see that amateur golfers make when you play with them? And what would, if you could rectify a couple of those errors, what would they be?
It's always you can improve an amateur's game with strategy. And if you can pitch the ball good and you can putt the ball good, I mean, nobody's perfect, right? We saw, what do we see here? Scotty Scheffler won the tournament last week on 14, the hole around the corner. He was behind the magnolia tree, duffed it coming out. Then he hit a 9-iron on the green and hold a 40-footer. That was where he won the tournament. That was on 15. 16, he drove it right, had hacked it out of the bunker, then had the layup again. Then he hit a great wedge shot up and made par. That saved the tournament again. Then he parred the last two holes. The last hole, he drove it in the rough. So the last four holes, he pretty much played terrible. He hit one green, he hit 50 feet on 17, and everybody, all we remember is that he won the tournament. So how'd he do that? So he got over his shots real quick. Got over the bad shots real quick. He was able to focus in, try to make the most out of the hole. Of course, he putts great, but he never hit a good shot on the last four holes.
I'd have hated to have had to have played those last four holes from where he played it from. I'm not sure the outcome would have been as effective as his outcome was.
Well, look at Gary Woodland. Gary Woodland, he's the one that's got to be kicking himself. He eagled 16 and basically he stands on 17 tee. If you and I were standing there with our caddies, we're three good shots away from winning this tournament.
Yep.
We knock a 7-iron or whatever shot it is on 17. We get that on the green, even if it was 40 feet, you can two-putt that and drive it into fairway on 18. This tournament is pretty much over.
Yeah.
And he hit it in the front bunker at 17. Pretty much the only place you can't hit it on 17. You really can go over and still make three. So maybe that was an error. And then he drove it in the rough on 18 and it cost him the tournament. But to try to answer your question, Chase, it's not always perfect when you're playing the golf. People will miss a fairway and they think they've lost their swing. And you very rarely have you ever lost your swing. You're usually only a degree or two. I mean, that's all you do up there is look at degrees on the computer. I mean, you do a lot of things, but you see that they're not far off. And one little adjustment. The best thing is to know your swing, right? Know what your swing is in your mind's eye. And how do I keep it somewhere in that playable area, to keep this thing going, right? Pitching the ball is important. Wedge shots are important. Putting's important, but thinking is probably as important as anything. Scotty Scheffler let himself win. He believed that he was going to win that tournament, Hal, on about the 14th hole. He believed that was his. And he didn't really have a shot at it. And then all it was, he won it. And he believed it all along. And that was good.
Well, you know yourself, Elk. Out there, all you're trying to do is stay close to the lead and hope that winning runs into you. I mean, there were several times that I look back at my career and I I'm coming down the back nine, and I don't know if I got a chance to win or not. I'm just up there kind of near the lead. I mean, do I get the good breaks? Do I get the bad breaks? You just keep staying around. And yeah, that's kind of what Scotty did this last weekend.
Yeah, and Woodland's got to be the one now thinking, man, I'm the one that blew that. I mean, Horschel had a shot at it. He fought hard and had a look at it. So did Victor Hovland. He had a look at it. So they won't be as disappointed. Someone was asking me yesterday, would those guys be exhausted after last week? I said, not those two. Those two, they'd be fine. I think Woodland would be a little exhausted after what he had a look at it. But you're right. I mean, you don't know. When you're near the lead, sometimes your game is under control totally. I'd like to sit here and tell you that, you know, your game is hitting it right where you're looking every shot, but a lot of times it's just not. And but you look next to you at the guy playing with you, and he's not doing everything right either. So that sometimes that gives you a little confidence.
Right.
So were you how did you handle swing thoughts? Were you a swing thought guy? Were you more visualization target guy? How are you in tournament mode?
I always like to have a swing thought that I was working on. You know, I always knew where the club face was pretty much in my swing. I still do feel like I know where the club face is. So, and you always not laugh at me, but because I stand where I want to stand, you know, so I can utilize where I think that club face is going. Didn't really make much difference to me where I stood with my feet, although it was almost always open. People always say you were open, but I said, I'm not open for me. That's where I got to stand to hit it where I'm going. So I wasn't that concerned about, I've never put an alignment stick on the ground in my life. You know, I aim the face, and then I set myself so I can work my body to hit that ball where I'm going there.
When you were struggling, like you're say middle of a round in the say on Friday, you make the cut, but you're not hitting it as good as you could, you know, you're expecting to, do you head to the range and grind? Let's say you find something, you know, late Friday night, let's say you're in 15th or so a couple of good rounds can get you back in the lead. Do you take a thought to Saturday? Do you, you know, how do you handle, you get over to me, it's always fascinating asking players like you and Hal, and, you know, we had Watson on, and Tom talked about when he won the US Open with the famous chip at Pebble, he was sitting like a dog Thursday, Friday, and he found something on the range Friday night and literally went to, he said every full shot he hit from that point on, from after Friday, he had a swing thought in his head. It was working on a different, slightly different backswing. Did you ever go that route, or did you try to keep it more target based?
No, I, there was things you find on the range, but it's got to be tested. I got a call, but it's going to kick out of here. Oh, and, you can still see me? Okay. It's just someone's ringing me, but it'll go off. I like to think that I find it on the range, but to me, it always had to be tested on the course. So there we go. So I've never found much on the range. I can find a starting point on the range, but when I have to get on the golf course and say, okay, I usually make my best adjustments on the course. I can do it mid-round, and you know, I might be not playing so good and then stand a certain way or feel what I'm working on and get back into it. I would play a fade. So as always, and I play a push fade, slight push. So, you know, standing to the left and having that feel of being able to the target out to the right. It was always mostly the problems that I would arise, and you know it, I would slide into the ball a little too much. So I was always trying to be rotary. So, you know, the further I was open, the more I would slide. So I would try to square off and spin, square off and open up. So it was a combination of trying to work my way through that. And when I was doing really well, I could step across the line with my feet and draw it. So that was a bonus.
Al, any thoughts on how you kind of got through, again, this is always such a fascinating topic for me, how you guys got through rounds when you weren't hitting at your best, or you know, where your brain was going at certain times when, you know, either you were on and it was all visual, or you were a little bit off and you had to kind of band-aid it together.
Well, when I got off, I'd retreat a little bit, and, you know, I'd play what I thought was a sure shot, whatever that was, whether it was a 3-wood off the tee, something that gained me confidence. And, you know, and I try to put one confident shot next to another confident shot. And if you could hit two or three in a row, I don't know what Elk thinks about this, but if I could hit, you know, multiple shots back to back, even though they might not be the most aggressive or impressive shot, but in my mind, I knew I hit the shot I was trying to hit, then that usually gained me enough confidence to step up the pace a little bit. But sometimes you're just not playing well enough. You just don't have enough inner confidence to be able to do that. And, you know, and I was like Elk, very seldom do you find something on the practice tee that you feel like is going to work. You may take it to the golf course the next day. And if the first couple of shots work, well, then
you found something. Jackpot a little bit. It starts to multiply a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always funny.
You know, you might hit a particular shot on a hard hole that gives you confidence, you know, like I'm thinking of this course or even the course we're talking about, TPC, you know, you might get on, you know, the fifth hole and just drive one right up on top of that hill, Hal, and you're like, okay, all right, that's exactly what I'm looking for right there. And that gives you a little bit of confidence to keep going. So, but it's all a bit of a battle, you know, Jackie Burke used to prepare me. I'm sure he did for Hal. It was never going to be perfect. You got to be prepared for it. You got to be ready for a disaster is what he said. Yeah. So you got to be ready for it. That's why, you know, I built my game, you know, I wanted to be able to fade it two ways and I wanted to be able to draw it two ways. So if one was not working, I was like a four barrel carburetor. You know, I could go to one other way and try to get it going that way. I had a low fade and a high fade, a low draw and a high draw. So they weren't, very rarely all four was going, but usually I could get two of them going.
So touch base on your four shots. How do you, again, I've told people, I was telling Hal this before, and you know, we talked about this right when you first came on, like you're so aware of your feet and how you set up and you kind of hit, like I like to hit little push cuts too. And I tell my students, I preset my fade, and that's what you do too. You kind of preset all your shots. So talk our audience through how you hit the kind of the, just a little elevator pitch on how you hit the four different shots.
Well, my standard shot, which was a fade, I would, especially on the longer clubs, I would be slightly left and I would play a slightly inside out swing action. So I could still get my spine tilt back a little bit to get the height on the ball that I wanted. When I got with the shorter clubs, I could square off a little bit and I could come out on the way down and play a trap fade, like a trap fade, kind of like, I don't know, maybe Tiger did, or not so much Bruce Liske, but I would square off more. Instead of having a shift to the right, I would shift it to the left, and I had plenty of loft, and I could play an angle hinge, so I could hit a lower, you know, trajectory short iron. On the right side of the ball, it was pretty much the same. I would, on the drivers and the long irons, I could stand square for me and swing inside out with a slightly rotating face. So I could hit the high draws, keep my tilts back so I could let the club pass and get my arms up. And on the wedges and so on, I could square off again, kind of like a Patrick Reed. Patrick Reed plays what I look like, what I call a D2, which is a draw the second way. He sort of closed off, balls forward, and he can cover, get his shoulders more parallel to the ground coming down. I can play that lower draw. So those are my four. And then when I was swinging really good, I had a F0, which is one in the middle, which I could kind of do everything without thinking about it. It was just, I was on fire and I would just play what I felt.
You're also one of the first, you know, really good players that I've ever talked to that moved the ball more forward to draw it and moved it back to fade it. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, as long as, you know, when I talk to amateurs about drawing the ball, you know, if the path is, you know, 5 degrees in to out and the face is four, it's going to draw, right? So I like the ball up, so I want height on it. So, and you're in on your second one was the draw?
Yeah, well, yeah. So the draw, yeah. So you move it, because, you know, you look up old school golf books, they talk about moving it back to draw it and moving it forward to fade it. And one of the things that I personally think it's easier to hit bigger draws from a ball more forward because you have time to square up the face. versus you move it back, the face is more open. It's easier to hit kind of push cuts. And you echoed and said that's how you played too. So yeah, you said move it forward to draw it, and then you'd move it back to get it to curve to the right.
Yeah, that's right. Just aim further left with the ball back. Yeah.
Kind of push draw, kind of push, or you're almost hitting push fades and pull draws, right?
Right. And you know, when you go and work at a place like, you know, Hal's, and you see it on film, and someone like you that's educated enough to, you know, see the arcs and the angles of descent, if you think of the swing not so much as where your positions are, your arms or everything, if you can reproduce, because we never had all that, Hal and I, we never really looked on camera, we never certainly never had readouts of degrees, but you can train your brain to, it's like a shoelace, right? It's a ribbon. You can feel where the swing's going in your mind's eye. And that's kind of how I played. I mean, I felt it was here and then I was under there, you know, and you can tell me exactly what it is on the video, right? With the amount of degrees, but you certainly have a feel. I say this to a lot of people all the time. If I had TrackMan all over, if I had my whole career all over again, would I use TrackMan? And I would say, of course I would, because it gives you, you know, you could get back on so quick. But still, even if you know all the numbers, unless you know which body parts to hold back and which ones to move, you're not going to get anywhere. I was at the Women's US Open. I saw all the girls had TrackMans, but they had to sit around and wait for the coach to come by, someone like you, to tell them how to change the picture.
So you mentioned old school and new school and all that sort of stuff. Old school, which Elk and I would have to be part of that old school. You know, when we first went out on the tour, we thought path had everything to do with our most of thing. You know, that's why we'd move the ball back to hit a draw, and that's why we'd move the ball forward to hit a fade. After we played for a while, we realized the face had a whole lot to do with what we were doing. And, you know, now – we know exactly where the face is at. Most players that are playing all the time, they know the ball's going to start wherever that face is pointed. Path has something to do with it, but not nearly as much. So, you know, the game has changed. To me, what data has done is it's given us a basis so that we can get back to being who we are quickly. You know, like you said, you're not far off very long.
Yeah, and I like that there's some medium range hitters still up there where they're not all, you know, I get so tired of people telling me, look at this kid, he's got 185 mile an hour club head speed. It doesn't, I'm glossed over by now, you know, I'm glossed over already from people telling me to come see speed. I want to see someone that hit the green on 17, you know, at Players. That's what I want. I want to see that lower trajectory iron shot under control, you know. And I'm only using Morikawa's name because he's one of the best players out there, and he's a medium range hitter, but he has a lot of control on his ball, and nobody talks about Morikawa's speed, and all they do is talk about how good he is. But we're always reminded of these other guys with how much speed they have, and I'm tired of it. I want to see the precision. I'm impressed with the speed, you know. And another point was, I might play with you in a tournament back in the day, or Jack or Weisskopf or someone else, and I'd see a shot and I'd see where they had the ball and I saw what happened, and I might go to the range and work on that and see if I could do that shot the way they did it. That's how a lot of we learned empirically, right? Watching other good players. That's where I learned more about golf than anywhere, was watching other tour players.
No doubt. That is exactly where we all learned. You know, I've told the story on here. Raymond Floyd put me under his arm in 1982 and said, you don't really know how to compete yet. So every Tuesday, you and I are going to play together, and I'm going to show you how to really compete. And I learned so much from Raymond. It was unbelievable. I got a question for you, Elk. This would be a great one. I think a lot of people would be interested in this. Houston had long heritage of a great golf team, the Houston Cougars.
Yeah.
You and Billy Ray played together at Billy Ray Brown, for everybody listening there. Kind of the last of the great teams at Houston. Am I right or wrong about that?
Well, we did win three national championships, so that was a lot. But we felt like we were loaded. There was other good teams. You know, Oklahoma State was the ones that always were right there. You know, they had Tway and Verplank and Andy Dillard, Willie Wood, Tommy Moore, Tracy Phillips, all those guys. Billy Ray and I were the two standouts on our team, but we had some other good players. Billy Tootin, who was a Pub Leagues champion. Dave Tentis was on our team. He was a long player. Mike Stanley won on tour in Louisiana one year. We had a handful, about eight other guys who were all big guys. And, looking back on college, we were good competitors. Our team was a unit, man. We were ready to roll. We had no attitude other than winning. And we wanted to kick Oklahoma State's ass and Texas's ass and everyone else's ass. And that's what was all about for us back then. We never got tired of beating them.
Well, you gave me part of my answer.
Okay.
Oklahoma State's still good. What happened to Houston?
Well, that's a good question. You know, my son Sam went through there, Coach Dismute. They've got a few good players that are popping up here and there, but they've not been able to put it all together. I don't know. I don't know if it's the coach. Everyone said Dave Williams couldn't coach, but he won 16 times, and they get the best coach, and they don't do anything. So, you know, when I start to think of top teams, you know, is it the facilities? We got great facilities. I mean, we didn't have any facilities, and we were great. I don't think you have to have great facilities. It certainly helps for recruiting. I don't know how. I mean, it's got to be players, right? You've got to have good players, or you can't do anything. I mean, I watched a college tournament recently, Arizona State. I think they won their tournament by like 8 strokes. They got one kid on that team that's like a freshman and almost won the U.S. Amateur. They got good players, but certainly it's got to be culture.
So Dave Williams out-recruited everybody in those years. And, you know, so it comes right down to the player.
Got to be players.
I mean, whether it's football, whether it's basketball, whether it's baseball, or whether it's golf, you cannot do it without the players. And
well, I'll tell you a little stat about Dave Williams and Billy Ray and I. You mentioned Billy Ray was my roommate in college there. We came on the team in 82. I was coming from Australia. He was coming from Sugarland over here. And Coach Williams would call me every Saturday in Wagga Wagga, Australia at 6 a.m. and tell me I was coming over there to play at U of H, and I was going to be playing with Billy Ray Brown from Sugarland, Texas. I thought he was crazy. I didn't know what he was talking about. And not one player recruited me other than Coach Williams, and not one player – this is pre-internet – and no one recruited Billy Ray. We were two freshmen, both first-team All-Americans our first year. Billy Ray won the individual at Pinehurst when we won in 82. And no one even recruited either one of us. Now, I bet you every school in the country would be recruiting us from overseas and the like with the internet and everything now. So it's changed a lot.
So I think that Coach Williams, you know, Coach Williams tried to recruit me and I didn't end up coming to Houston. But I think he could see more of what was in a person. And, I had a lot of respect for Coach Williams. Super nice guy. He had one of the sweetest wives in the world. I know you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
He used to call me in Shreveport and he'd say, "Hal, the water's fine down here in Houston. You need to come jump in."
I remember when
I had no idea what he meant until I moved to Houston. Now I realize it rains all the time.
Yeah, no kidding. I remember when he recruited John Mahaffey, he told me, and Mahaffey told me, I said, "How did he recruit you?" Because he was like 5'7" back in, you know, coming out of high school. And he said, because he was a good 3-point shooter on the basketball team. He said, anyone that had that much confidence could let it go from out there. He said, I wanted him on the golf team. He'd won a couple of tournaments. And I'm like, how did you put that together?
Yeah. Well, the Cougars were awfully good, no doubt about it.
Yep. You know, I was lucky. I was there with Akeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler was both recruited. They were both freshmen when Billy Ray and I were there. We know those guys well, and they lived in our dorm, and they went on to do two championships and none in college, but we'd let them come down to our rooms on Friday nights and let them wear those rings around, let them get the feel of it a little bit, those national championship rings. They could wear it on their pinky finger on the tip.
Yeah. Great guys.
Yeah, both are great guys.
Yeah, they really are. Well, Elk, thanks for being on. You've been fun, and it's a fun week for both of us. We both,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. We can close it with this. Every time I went to TPC, I felt there was just something different about it. It was exciting to be there, and I'm sure you felt the same way.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't care what they say, whether it's a major or not. We both have a PGA, so that's not in our conversation. But it was the most important event at the time when we both won it. It felt, it had the same feel to me as winning the PGA, you know, and it was the best field and it was the most money. And you got the accolades from your fellow peers because they know how hard that course was. And hey, that's all you're really looking for. Playing that course under that much pressure. They know, everybody knows how hard it is to play that course coming down the stretch. And that's where you get all the rewards from, is looking at it this week. You're going to look at it. I'm going to look at it and go, you know what? That was a hard damn shot. These guys getting ready to hit on 17 and 18. And we were there.
Yep.
Hit it. And that's a fact.
Yeah.
Well, Elk, we got heater on. Come hit some balls. If you want to come hit some balls, we'll keep you warm.
I might come up and see you.
Well, thanks.
Thanks again, Elk.
Thanks again, sir. Always a pleasure.
Guys. All right. Bye now.
Be the right club today. Yes!